Welcome to another edition of San Luis Valley Voices, a production of SL Voices, your voice in the San Luis Valley. Without further ado, enjoy the program.
National Suicide Prevention Month is recognized throughout September as mental health advocates, prevention organizations, survivors, allies, and community members all unite to promote suicide prevention awareness. San Luis Valley Health Behavioral Health Specialists and SL Voices want to help you learn more about tools and strategies to cope with stress and challenges in life. Signs and symptoms of suicidality, various high-risk groups, the services available from a national level all the way down to locally, and a lot more.
I'm Adam, and September is National Suicide Prevention Month, observed here in the San Luis Valley and across the country. Each year, thousands of Americans consider suicide, and sadly, many actually attempt it. Especially during this stressful time, your mental health is extremely important and something to pay close attention to. Joining us for a look at National Suicide Prevention Month, factors, warning signs, and a lot more are several professionals from San Luis Valley Health. I'd like to introduce Gina Bousquet. Gina is a medical assistant with primary care. Laura Burkhart, she is LCSW, and you can explain to me what that means in a little bit, and a behavioral health therapist. Micaela Romero, also LCSW, behavioral health therapist. And finally, Monica Heinz, Director for the Emergency Department at the RMC Regional Medical Center. What a wonderful group of people to get together with. Thank you so much for joining us. And let's get right to this all-important topic of discussion, National Suicide Prevention Month. It's throughout September. Mental health advocates, prevention organizations, survivors, allies, and community members are all uniting to promote suicide prevention awareness. And that's really why we're doing this podcast. You know, there are some disturbing statistics that I read prior to this interview. Suicide is a leading cause of death in the U.S. and is considered a national public health crisis. It's actually in 10th place for adults overall and in second place for those aged 15 to 34. It's estimated that around 15% or 9.3 million adults will experience depression at least one point or another throughout their life. Colorado is one of the states with the highest rate of suicides, ranking 10th in the nation. Rural communities in the state have a higher rate of suicide than urban areas. There are over 300 million people in the world living with depression right now, according to the World Health Organization. Current estimates are that roughly 800,000 people complete suicide every year, with about 25 times more than that attempting so. And further, according to the CDC, suicide rates are up over 30% for the last 20 years. So there are some disturbing statistics, and we can talk about all of that. First, let's touch on some of the basic factors that lead to suicidal thoughts and why.
I think that for a lot of people who suffer or who may be in denial of suffering from aspects of depression, a lot of people, when they think of depression, they think of the basis of just sadness or feeling lonely, pain, hurt, whether it be on a physical or emotional level, but it goes much deeper than that. Aspects of depression are associated with panic attacks, anxiety, tension, stress. And a lot of people who experience this are people who come from backgrounds of whether it can be from having no job to having the highest paid job in the world.
Underneath, we know a lot of the anxiety and depression is a history of trauma. And often with that comes attempt to self-medicate with substances. And we do know that completion of suicide is higher for people who are using or abusing drugs or alcohol.
What are some of the warning signs of suicide that people should be looking out for?
Based on what Laura said, we'll start to notice increased substance use, and that's alcohol or other drug use, based on wanting to feel differently or to kind of change our experience. We might notice more aggressive behavior or more behavior that's consistent with anxiety or depression, right? So withdrawing from family or friends, not engaging in enjoyable tasks from the past, whether that's hobbies or spending time with other people. We might notice people saying things like believing they're a burden to their family or friends. We might see impulsive or reckless behaviors, things that are out of character for the individual. And then we might also just hear direct statements about wanting to end their life, finding that they're feeling more hopeless, or maybe even making passive comments about their thoughts around suicide.
Let's discuss the following groups and why they can be especially at risk to suicide. First peoples.
The statistics I read on First People is that the youth, years 10 to 24 years old, experience the highest rate of suicide. in the entire population of the United States. That's 3.5 times more likely to die by suicide compared to other groups. And I think factors that contribute to this, one is the historical trauma passed down from generation to generation, starting, of course, in colonial times when the genocide of First Nations people occurred, and the continued marginalization and discrimination faced by this population.
What about veterans?
I think that veterans in particular are affected because most people, when they think of veterans, they think of men and women who are coming back from a time of war, and they think that's when the fight is over, when in fact the battle is just beginning, especially for people who are 25 or under who are still trying to grow up themselves and learn about life, learn about themselves, and they come back from such trauma that they're not exactly prepared for when they first go in. I mean, sure, they get the facts from the media, from social media, from family, friends who've been there before, but for themselves in particular, to get that firsthand experience is unlike any other thing that they'll experience in their lives, especially when they go in and they're groomed to develop a family relationship with people around them, and it's those very people that they come back without, or that they have to watch be injured, or indeed they're injured themselves.
So it's a transitional thing, coming back into society from the military mindset.
Other factors for veterans is just the military culture of being able to handle your problems on your own and do things on your own without getting help. Historically, the military has discouraged people from reaching out for help for mental illness. I know they're making steps to address that, but there could be some real consequences for disclosing that someone was suffering from mental health issues, including losing your job or status in the military. And so that combined with just the stigma in general against folks reaching out can be a huge barrier. There is a lot of veterans that live in our valley. 10% of the valley is a veteran. And we know that rural veterans are at 20% increased risk compared to veterans in urban areas. So for people who live here, they are at specific risk for suicide.
1 in 5 of us. Wow.
I think I would add to that as well, Adam, to say that with the advances in military technology, folks are surviving incidents that they would have died from in the past. Because of that, we're noticing what Gina mentioned, that folks are coming back with traumas that they would have never survived in the past. The other part of that is that veterans tend to have more experience with weapons. And so we know that suicide is most deadly when someone uses a firearm, right? And so in that way, that increases their risk as well.
And if it's okay to mention here a couple of resources for veterans.
Sure.
There was a pilot project in the Valley Cod together with veterans, and this was a coalition of all different professionals in the Valley as well as the Veteran Voice. From that, we learned just the need for collaboration among the helping professionals in the Valley to connect these veterans with resources is huge, especially for a population who sometimes want to be somewhat isolated and hidden. So a great resource for veterans who need help really with anything, be it navigating the VA system or getting connected with housing resources or food, the Veteran Coalition of the San Luis Valley. And they can be reached at 719-992-4108.
Richard Nagley's group.
Yes. There are a lot of resources in the Valley for people that are, you know, having anxiety or depression or they're having suicidal thoughts. And we, as the emergency department, are definitely one of those resources that we ask people to reach out to when they are having those feelings and there are no other resources available to them. So we can make sure that we can work towards finding them the help and the resources that they need.
Is there a particular way to reach out to you for that?
So basically, it's calling 911 if you feel like you are unable to come to the emergency department, or just showing up in the emergency department admissions desk and saying that you need that help because you are feeling suicidal or depressed. We don't turn anybody away. We will make sure that we evaluate everyone. And if we feel that they need additional resources than what we can provide, then we make sure that we find those resources for them.
Excellent.
What about, because I know a lot of times we do see this in primary care with established patients or people who are coming in for transfer of care because the VA sent them. The men and women who are too proud or too angry or too frustrated, and they've always been taught and shown and groomed to handle things for themselves, as Laura mentioned, not to seek out for help. You're bigger than the problem itself. And you're groomed to act like the bigger person, to drive on, and this is what you're made to do. This is what you signed up for. What about the people that come in and don't recognize always that they're in danger, or people around them that are in danger, anger issues, aggressive, but they're not seeing the bigger picture in front of them?
I think that's a nice segue, Gina, into the integrated approach that we have in primary care. And when I say that, really, we're moving towards this idea that our emotional and mental health is directly related to our physical health. And so I'm lucky to work down the hall from Gina, and we try to screen every single patient who comes through our door for any emotional distress, primarily depression and anxiety. And then from there, we have conversations to also assess for suicidality, and we'll try to connect with resources and make a plan for safety at that point in time.
I think to add to that as well is that mental health and mental illness exist on a continuum. And so I think being able to talk to folks about that is really important, and recognizing that not everybody that has suicidal thoughts or not everybody that's experiencing depression or anger or anxiety is going to be hospitalized. You know, the key's not going to get thrown away, that type of thing. There's a lot of resources and a lot of steps that can be implemented prior to sort of the most extreme step of hospitalization.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think by educating folks or even offering other resources besides that, hopefully we can kind of have a soft in with folks around mental health and getting services in that way.
So Laura had mentioned about screening every patient that comes in for primary care. Through the emergency department, we've instituted a measure where we're really taking those behavior health complaints right now and making sure that we're screening each of those individuals coming in, because even if they're not a suicide complaint or they could be a substance use, we try to ask them those questions if they feel safe or if they feel like harming themselves, if they need some additional resources. And so over this last year in the emergency department, we have really increased our numbers with that population as far as making sure that we are screening them during the triage process and then asking those additional questions depending on what their answers are in triage and then getting them those resources as they need. And we are going to continue that through this next year and hopefully add more individuals to that and not just those behavior health complaints that come in. But it is a difficult conversation to have through the emergency department because it's hard to start up a conversation with someone if they're coming in for an ankle sprain, but that might be their third or fourth ankle sprain in the week. And so we tend to see how many times we see these patients and if there's something else that might be underlying on why they're coming to see us that we just haven't been able to acknowledge at this point.
What you're saying is you're taking a whole health approach.
We are attempting to try to do that, yes.
That's great. Well, I think like veterans, there is a stigma among the male population about getting help. What can we do about that? Or what suggestions do you have for men that, look, it's okay to hurt. It's all right to reach out for help.
The resource I was looking up is called mantherapy.org.
Mm-hmm.
And so I highly encourage everybody to go to this website that's using humor to kind of address this issue of stigma that we've created as a society against men from struggling with anything. There's coping skills and just different educational material on mental health conditions. And so it's a fun website.
And I think just in general, Adam, to answer that question, talking about it, I think is the way that people ultimately start to create wiggle room around that stigma, right? So if they know that a friend or a family member has gone to therapy, or even if their friend or family member is able to be transparent about the way that they're feeling or past experiences, I find that that is one of the most effective ways to create a space for vulnerability, which is what's necessary when we're talking about difficult emotions or even thoughts of suicide.
This kind of might be a little digression, but since we're on the topic of stigma, first responders are also at a much higher rate for risk of suicide, 20% from the general population. And again, a culture of stigma around reaching out and getting help. First responders are the helpers. They're the ones who put themselves last in order to take care of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that specific population, there is a crisis line for police officers, 741-741, and they can text the word blue, and that will connect with someone who's familiar with that culture.
Excellent. I had mentioned earlier on that suicide is a leading cause of death here in the U.S., considered a nationwide public health crisis. And that it's in second place, actually, for those aged 15 to 34. And that's one of the groups that I wanted to mention that are certainly at risk for suicide are our youth.
Yeah, and we find that especially, Adam, to be true for youth that are on the LGBTQ spectrum. And that just calls to mind this organization called the Trevor Project. The Trevor Project is an organization that offers services 24/7 in a cool way, right? So they do it by phone, through text, or through chat, which can really increase accessibility to especially young people. And so they tend to serve folks that are under the age of 25. And the cool thing about them is that they offer sort of a continuum of care. And so they're trying to provide counseling services to folks in crisis that identify on that spectrum, offer resources to the community. So this might be schools or family members. And they're also trying to advocate for laws and policies that will be more protective of our LGBTQ youth.
I know at one point, pre-COVID, there was a monthly meeting going on, a support group meeting. Is this going to be picking up again, or are they meeting online?
SLV Pride. From what I last heard, they were having online meetings, but there is a contact link on their website, slvpride.org, where you can inquire there.
Very good.
I think this is particularly important, I think now more than ever, because so many today, regardless of race, regardless of age, regardless of upbringing, someone's background, this is something that's impacting a lot of people today. We have a lot of stigma that comes from, primarily a lot of it from social media, just because when someone is in the middle of transitioning, say from female to male or vice versa, during that time of transition, and we see it all the time with our celebrities especially, they get ridiculed, they get shamed. It's almost on to the point of, in comparison to slut shaming, to the exact point. And today, even especially here in healthcare, there's quite a bit of patients that we get in who are not so forthcoming when talking about sex compared to individuals who are in these relationships. A lot of times people will refer to my husband, my wife, versus people who are in same-sex relationships saying my partner, the person I'm with, significant other. So there's still quite a great deal of that shame, that guilt, that resentment, or what will people say? What is their opinion going to be?
To pick up on that, some of the factors when we try to understand why this population is at increased risk for suicide, like Gina said, with rejection, family rejection, they found that youth who had no family support versus the youth who were rejected by their family were much higher risk of suicide. The LGBTQ plus youth are at higher rates of homelessness and experience more violence and job and education discrimination. And this population in general faces a lot more discrimination and stigma in the healthcare setting, so they're less likely to get help when they need care. And a few more resources to link to at the end of the page is Trans Lifeline, and we'll put the number for that. And then SAGE LGBT Elder Hotline for older adults who they can come here for peer support and also any local resources. I say local in quotation marks because maybe Pueblo or somewhere.
And of course, all these links will be listed on the podcast page. So if you're listening to this out and about somewhere, drop by slvoices.com. Go to this particular podcast page. All the links and all that information will be on there. So if you need them, please feel free to use them. Circling back around to groups that are especially at risk of suicide, survivors are at risk again.
Yeah, we do know through the research that if you've had a prior attempt at suicide, then you'd be more likely to have another attempt or to die by suicide. And on this note, also if there's a family history of suicide, you're more at risk for suicide yourself.
And lost survivors. And I'm assuming that not just people who've lost someone to suicide, but people who have lost someone in general, they are at risk too?
I think when we use the word loss, it can really encompass lots of different things. That can be loss of a loved one. It can be loss of stability in your life due to financial changes. It can be moving and losing your support system. And so because of those losses, you could almost feel like you've lost your anchor, or sometimes if it's related to work, you can feel like you've lost your sense of purpose. And so I think in those ways, those can be risk factors for increased rates of suicide.
I realize we are really just mere months into the entire COVID thing, roughly 6 months in now. Has there been an increase in suicide or suicide attempts over this here in the Valley at all? Has that been noticed?
I don't know about the Valley specifically. I do know that some early tracking and studies are showing an increase. And then from the nations that were hit earlier, now that data is coming out that there had been an increase in suicidality.
What is imminent risk, and why is it so important for someone to act immediately?
Imminent, meaning close to hand or nearby, versus maybe what we'd call chronic or passive suicidality, is somebody who is in such emotional or physical pain, experiencing frantic hopelessness, and these ruminating thoughts of suicide are more likely to act on those thoughts and to potentially die from suicide. So when we are in conversation with people who are experiencing suicidal thoughts, we often will explore if they're having any ideas specifically how they would act on those thoughts. We call that a plan. So if they have a plan for how they'd complete suicide, and then if they have access to that plan. So that will help us know if they have a plan and means. For example, if someone said that they would kill themselves with a firearm, but they don't have a gun, then that would decrease the level of immediacy. If they have a plan and means at that point, it's really necessary to intervene because in those states of hopelessness, suicide sometimes feels like the only option. And in survivors that I've spoke with, as soon as they take the action, there's immediate regret that that wasn't actually the action. So there's a lot of ambivalence with suicide, meaning that people go back and forth a lot. So if there can be an outsider to intervene and to interrupt that process.
What would you recommend as far as immediate action?
That's a great question. I think immediate action when somebody has plan, means, and intent is to call 911. We need to get folks in there quickly and be able to avert a potential crisis if possible.
Did you want to add to that?
What I can say about working in primary care, one of the greatest things, one of our strong suits is when a person is coming in, whether it's for a follow-up visit, established care, transfer of care, any circumstance. When the patient comes in, it's not just for the sole purpose of what the appointment was made for. When they come in, we're looking at all aspects, what they're talking about, how they're talking, their behavior patterns, what they're associating themselves with, their level of tension, stress. If they happen to say something that kind of catches our attention, we then hand it off to providers, we meet about it, and then we get a care coordinator, we get a behavioral health personnel involved. And so that's one of the biggest things that actually works towards our patients' benefits is even when they're just coming in for something as simple as a routine exam, but that can be the start of something that they didn't even know that they were going to get help for. So I think that's one of the greatest benefits.
I'm glad you brought that up, Gina, because in addition to the emergency department as being a resource, primary care is too. In those times of intense stress, sometimes it's hard to remember who to call. So always feel free to call our office and to get scheduled with your primary care provider or anybody who has an opening.
I think to add on also to what Gina was saying, and Laura mentioned this earlier, that our annual screenings for folks, part of that is what we really want to achieve is being able to integrate that into the culture. So it doesn't feel like we're singling people out because of things that we notice, like Gina mentioned, but that we're just kind of doing it across the board and it would be like any other question that you would be asked in a primary care setting. So it just feels like, you know, a true integration between mental and physical health.
I did mention earlier, LCSW. What does that stand for and what does that mean?
Licensed Clinical Social Worker. When you're seeking mental health treatment, you'll see a lot of these acronyms and it's just a different background in education. So Michaela and I both are clinical social workers. You might also see a licensed professional counselor, a LPC, or a LMST, a licensed marriage and family therapist are some of the common ones.
All of these mean training as well. Mm-hmm. You've gone through, and I would assume too, you continue to go through training.
Correct.
Because things change along the way. You learn new things. And you have to go back for what, refresher courses and such too?
Yeah.
What is the mission of the Behavioral Health Department here at San Luis Valley Health?
Our mission, Adam, is to improve the health of all patients by integrating behavioral health and medical services, like we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, right, through counseling and therapy, we hope that we can really help folks to address the root of their problems, to find new ways to cope and manage, and also to give them a sense of agency in their life.
What does that mission mean to you?
I think it goes back to what we've been talking about today with holistic health. It means that there's so many factors that affect how we're feeling and our well-being. I get excited about my job when we can start looking at some maybe of the less traditional reasons someone isn't getting well or they're not feeling just satisfied and healthy in their life.
Gina, what about you?
I think the mission of behavioral health, has different benefiting factors to it. It's more than just being mentally stable or being mentally well. It's hitting all checkpoints, whether it's I'm just not quite feeling like myself, but no, it doesn't mean I'm going to commit suicide. That can actually cause a lot of tension and stress and anger among a lot of people where they don't want to say, well, I'm not crazy. No, I don't need antidepressants. No, I'm not going to go home and do something crazy. It's really hitting along of, well, I'm waking up and I'm just feeling the pressures of my job. I'm feeling the pressures of parenthood. I'm feeling the pressures of, you know, anything that's really going on in someone's life, they can just kind of come in and get, you know, themselves back on track of where they usually are, what makes them happy, what makes them good at doing what they do.
Monica, anything you wanted to add to that from the emergency side?
I was just listening to Gina, and that's exactly what I think of the behavior health as well. As she mentioned at the beginning of the podcast is that, you know, it can happen to anybody. You don't have to be poor. You can be rich. You can have everything in the world, and you're still going to need some of that behavior health resources that are out there. Even though you may not be suicidal, it is definitely good to make sure that you're taking care of your own behavior health.
Regarding suicide prevention itself, what resources are available locally
In addition to everything that's been mentioned, the emergency room, primary care, and our behavioral health department at San Luis Valley Health, San Luis Valley Behavioral Health Group is also an amazing resource in our community, and they have a 24/7 on-call clinician. I know when COVID hit that they were doing most of their visits over the phone, so I'm not sure where that is right now, but to speak to an on-call clinician, call 719-589-3671. You'll tell the operator you're in crisis and you need to speak to the on-call clinician. They'll gather your information and someone will call you back. Just know that if you're calling after business hours, that it does go to dispatch and then they contact that person. Also, they also have a 24/7 walk-in counseling department, and it's Carmi Esperanza. They're located at 311 San Juan in Alamosa. It's open 8 a.m. to 11 p.m., and it's the same number there if you want to call ahead of time, 719-589-3671.
And of course, there is a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline as well, 1-800-273-TALK, which is 8255. Their website is suicidepreventionlifeline.org.
To that, I would also add NAMI Colorado as a resource. Right now, they're holding virtual support groups, which is really wonderful. As Laura mentioned, I think some of the closest chapters are in Pueblo, so that's a bit far for folks to travel. However, because they are being done virtually right now, you can kind of have those visits in your living room.
What would you recommend for someone who is starting to consider suicide? Where would you go with that?
I think it's important to really emphasize, put importance on the aspect, the fact that suicide is a permanent decision. Permanent action. And it's not something that you can do halfway through and decide to change your mind. Once it's done, it's done. And though you're escaping what is a temporary situation, in the long run, you're missing out on a whole other life filled with anything, opportunities, change of life. We never know one moment from the next what's going to happen to us, what's going to come along, what's going to shape us, what's going to mold us. And taking that away from ourselves, we're taking away everything. The gift, anything that can come along and change us later, maybe be there for someone else, maybe be that voice of reason, maybe start a movement. We never know one moment from the next who we're going to be. And so when you complete that action, it's much more than just taking away from that temporary feeling, situation, pain. You're taking away everything else that's in between.
As you said, it's permanent.
Yes.
I think probably at the very basic level, talk to somebody about it. Whether that's somebody in your family, whether that's somebody when you're coming in for a primary care visit, whether that's accessing any of these resources online or by phone. As Gina mentioned, in those moments when we are experiencing lots of pain, it's difficult to see outside of that narrow focus. And so when we're able to talk to somebody about it, they're able to hopefully open up that viewpoint a little bit and offer services, offer support that might have you kind of engaging in life differently after that point.
What about helping someone else who is considering suicide? What would you recommend some of the first steps people take?
I think it can be really scary if someone you know and love is considering suicide. My primary advice is to take time and listen to their story. First, really be with them, listening to their pain, and then validating what they're going through. And after you've taken time to be with them, let them know that you're there to support them. And if, going back to our conversation about imminent risk, if they have the intention, the means, the plan, and the means to carry out that plan, then drive them to the emergency or call 911. If it's not as imminent and they're experiencing hopelessness and just now beginning to have these thoughts, help them make the environment safe. If they have guns, offer to take the ammo out of the home, or best yet, take both. If they have pills and they're considering suicide from pills, then offer to help them get a lockbox. And don't feel like you have to do it alone. There's always the help of all these agencies we've been mentioning.
I think adding to what Laura just said about that, it's important that if when you're coming across someone with these tendencies or someone that is very serious about it, anything and everything that they tell you, take into account it's coming from a place of pain, a place of loss, a place of resentment towards themselves or anger towards themselves or someone else. So anything that they tell you, keep that confidential. Let them know they have your absolute trust. You're not there to judge them. You're not there to shame them. You are on their side, and treat the conversation just like that, regardless of what you're feeling inside or how intense it may be. Don't ever make them feel like they are a monster or less than. They're still a person inside and outside of that.
I'm glad, Gina, you brought up the concept of judgment. I think that for people who haven't been in that place of pain and desperation, it's easy to judge And so I always think of suicidality as a really brilliant way someone is thinking to find a way out of the pain, to gain some control in a life that feels totally chaotic. So if you can help honor the brilliance in their suicide while offering hope for another alternative.
What you're saying is in many cases, suicide or the thoughts or tendencies toward this is hurt-driven.
Absolutely.
I think to add to that as well, I would say to take them seriously. I think it takes a lot of courage often to be vulnerable with how we're feeling or thoughts that we have, especially if we're worried about being judged or if we even feel shame ourselves for having those experiences. And so in addition to kind of creating safety to that, I would also say take that very seriously, whatever disclosure is brought to you.
We've talked about overall physical and mental health too. What are some of the actions that one can take to care for their mental well-being throughout life and into the future, and to hopefully help prevent some of these suicidal thoughts or tendencies?
I think for a person to understand their limits, their goals, their expectations, and to know themselves as a person, whether they have been diagnosed from the time of a young age with a mental disorder, or they get it diagnosed later on in their lives, for them to understand their trigger points, to understand their stress levels, what becomes too much for them, what they're able to handle, and when it's okay to say, I can't take anymore, and to go ahead and step away from that.
Okay.
Well, I think that we've talked a lot today about the importance of talking about our feelings, and so many people are not brought up where that is okay or safe or acceptable. So learning now as adults to talk about our feelings and to even know what we're feeling so we can express that will prevent that from swelling up later in life, potentially to the point of considering suicide. And then some really basic tips when life can start to feel like it's more than you can bear. Just doing rigorous exercise, taking a cool shower, taking some deep breaths can help a lot with that stress. Create a routine for yourself that allows you to nurture yourself. This might mean waking up 5 minutes earlier to enjoy a cup of coffee before the kids wake up. It may mean scheduling a phone call with your sister once a week on your way home from work, but don't text and drive. Writing in a journal every night before bed. And lastly, I think to have fun. This can sound absurd to someone who's suffering from depression or who has a lot of stress in their life, but if we can do things that bring us joy and laughter, that greatly reduces stress.
Break out of the routine.
Yeah, create a routine and then break out.
It's more the mundane routine. You know, yeah. I go to work, I come home. I go to work, I come home. Break that routine.
Oh, I love that, Adam. Yeah.
How is San Luis Valley Health continuing to offer services at this time? Obviously, we're hopefully coming towards the end of this whole COVID thing, but still there are obviously restrictions and such in place.
I think for us right now, we're offering in-person visits, but we can also accommodate phone and video visits as well.
If you're going to be seen in person, I expect to be asked to wear a mask at all times in our clinic. And we also screen for COVID symptoms upon entering the building.
SLV Health has several locations and various services available throughout our San Luis Valley here. Who are you driven to serve and why?
All residents and visitors of the San Luis Valley.
And you've been doing this since 1927?
Yeah.
What are some of the best ways for people to reach you, to learn more about you or ask questions or whatnot?
You can get more information at our website, slvhealth.org, and there's a link there where you can ask questions, and Donna Weehee is great at getting back to you. To reach the Behavioral Health Department, call 719-589-8008, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have or schedule you for an appointment.
So with primary care, what I really like about our department is that if a person is not sure how to reach a therapist, reach a hotline, if they don't have a phone, if they're not really tech savvy, they can call in to our department and they can just make a regular scheduled appointment with their primary care provider or be asked to be placed on a provider schedule. And so while it may not be on the clinical side of treatment, you're welcome to come in, address your issues, and we will still get you connected with the resources that we have here.
Is there anything else that anybody would like to add on this?
I think just to reiterate that it will feel better if it feels like it won't. No feeling is permanent, and there's a lot of help out there, and you're not alone. It's really common to experience some feelings of suicide.
I think it's okay, personally, to be okay not to be okay, and to say exactly what you're feeling, and to acknowledge that I think, you know, everybody, when we think of success, when we think of wealth, we think of it in terms of money, we think of it in terms of careers. But I think that goes much deeper. People rarely ask, are you happy? But they will ask what you do for a living. They will ask how many kids you have, how many years you've been married. But how many times do you ask someone, how are you doing, in the terms of not just a generic question, but is this where you're okay being at?
And I think just a quick reminder that therapy isn't only for crisis situations. And so you can always reach out to us if you're just finding it more difficult to cope and manage with the stressors in your life, or if you want to learn how to manage differently, or if you're noticing that things from your past are starting to affect you differently than they did. Always reach out. We're here to help on that continuum of care.
Regina, Laura, Mikaela, and Monica, I want to thank you all for joining us to discuss National Suicide Prevention Month. You know, just as attending to our physical health, we all need to keep in mind our own and our family's mental health as well. If you or someone you know is considering suicide or even has mentioned it or is in need of help, please don't hesitate to reach out to San Luis Valley Health for immediate assistance. They're trained professionals. I've sat here and talked to them. I hear the care, I hear the concern, I hear the understanding, and they're here to help you through whatever it is that you're currently having difficulty coping with. All of their contact information, again, is going to be on this podcast webpage for you to reference and use. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Adam.
If you or someone you know is considering suicide, please know there is a wide range of assistance available right now. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is 800-273-TALK or 8255. Visit their website, suicidepreventionlifeline.org. You can also text NAMI, N-A-M-I, to 741-741 to be connected to a free, trained crisis counselor on the crisis text line. Or you can talk to someone at the Colorado Crisis Hotline at 844-493-TALK. That's 844-493-8255. On a local level, the mission of the Behavioral Health Department at San Luis Valley Health is to improve the health of all patients by integrating behavioral health and medical services. Through counseling and therapy, they can help address the root of your problems and find new ways to tackle them. Behavioral health services are available at Monta Vista Community Clinic on Stewart Avenue, Antonito Clinic, and La Jara Clinic. Call 719-589-8008 to make an appointment. That's 719-589-8008. Or visit their website, sanluisvalleyhealth.org. Special thanks to Donna Weehy, Director of Communications for SLV Health, for arranging this all-important podcast.
We appreciate you telling your friends to listen to the podcast on slvoices.com and check out our extensive calendar of events, more listings in one location than any other website around. You can help spread the word, too, by joining our Facebook group, SL Voices, Your Voice in the San Luis Valley, and liking our posts on other social media outlets. Also, check out our Instagram page for behind-the-scenes looks at what we do. And please, patronize our local sponsors. Remember to support the businesses here in the Valley. Most are owned and operated by your friends, family, and neighbors. We all love this area and want to see it flourish, and you can help by buying and supporting locally in your own and surrounding communities. Check back for another local podcast soon. Until then, this has been San Luis Valley Voices, a production of SL Voices, Your Voice in the San Luis Valley.